This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
And welcome to the last session of this terrific symposium. So this is the time where we get to take a bit of a deep breath and think about what we've heard during the course of the day. And we've got three elder statespersons to help us do that.
We've got four.
Have we? Oh, right, me too, yes. Okay. I'll introduce them in a minute, but if you think about the day, we've had some lovely personal moments and autobiographical reflections. Philip sitting there with his shell collection, that was a lovely moment. Jennifer talking about the politician going around the collection store and asking why there was so much junk. And Eric's day in, was it 1980, Eric? That fantastic description, the smoking. Yes. So we've had some of those lovely personal moments. We've had some very serious scientific talk and data about lighting, and that was incredibly interesting, I know, to many people in the audience. We've had some great case studies, both of projects like the Discovery Centre and objects like the Daimler. And we've had some pretty far-reaching and breathtaking policy positions put to us as well. So we've really covered an enormous range today as we've looked at the whole question of caring for collections. The three people who are going to kick off the discussion this afternoon, and the idea is that they'll say a few words, 5 minutes or so, and then we're going to throw the discussion open and ask you to think about what are the most interesting, thought-provoking things that you've heard today. Margie Byrne is has had a distinguished career in libraries, first in the State Library of New South Wales, and then as Assistant Director General at the National Library, looking after Australian collections. And we thought we'd bring her along here today, partly because she's been a long-standing champion of increasing the dialogue between libraries and museums. And, you know, museums have got a lot of things to learn from libraries. So we're always very pleased to have Margie. Michael Crayford has a background in regional art galleries before he joined the Australian National Maritime Museum, where he's responsible now as Assistant Director for Collections and Exhibitions. And John Greenwood, who's recently arrived only 10 months ago from England and has become a senior lecturer at the University of Canberra. He taught for 22 years at the University of Lincoln, teaching conservation, so he's really here to take up that role at the University of Canberra. So why don't we start immediately with Margie and hear what she thought were the most interesting, thought-provoking things that she heard today.
Louise and I didn't get our act together until a few minutes ago, which is fairly typical for me. So I've been thinking through the day about what I would say. And in fact, Louise has known me since my career in Sydney, but I had an earlier career in Australiana collections in South Australia, so Philip and I go back 10 years further than that. And I have had a 30-year career really building great Australiana collections in a variety of libraries. In terms of who I am, for the last 15 years I have been a program manager in two very large Australiana collections, the Mitchell Library at the State Library of New South Wales and now the National Library. So I've been responsible for all aspects of collection management, for database development, for cataloguing, for preservation and conservation, as well as for reader services and the building up of the Australiana collections for at least half of my career, which is a bit scary. And I was a child migrant, though not of the forgotten Australian variety. And so if there's a reason for me becoming a librarian, which is equivalent to Philip's juvenile interest in shell collecting. It's because as a 9-year-old I had to choose which books I could bring to Australia. And there weren't very many. And I still have some of them, and I'm rather mystified now about the choice. One was Flight 1 Australia, a ladybird book, which is fairly obvious, but another one's a New Zealand piece of fairly rubbishy children's literature, I think, called The Mystery of the Pa. Anyway, I guess I do have a different perspective as a librarian than many who work in museum collections, but I've very much enjoyed the active professional involvement I've had with museum colleagues, which for me does really go back to the early 90s when I was the library sector representative on the Heritage Collections Working Group and then the Heritage Collections Council. And as someone who's been responsible for building highly selective collections of documentary heritage materials such as archives and manuscripts, pictures, oral histories and so forth, I've felt intellectually a lot more in common with many museum professionals than I have done with, say, the great mass of librarians who are only dealing in books, or indeed with archivists, who a profession which is kind of numerically overwhelmed, at least, by people responsible for government records, which is a completely different professional activity than collecting archives. And I've always been stimulated and challenged and sometimes in great disagreement with museum colleagues. And I realised today that my bag is from the 1996 Museums Australia conference, which I see from inside the lapel. The flap was called Power and Empowerment, Museums Towards the New Millennium, which I thought was nicely resonant now that we're well and truly in it. But I have always found some of the expressions of some in the museum sector perplexing, and particularly in the early 1990s, in the foundation days of the Heritage Collections Council, the Collections Council and its predecessors, when I found the emphasis on interpretation, on telling stories, in fact, on telling the story in many cases, and a kind of hostility towards things that would be taken for granted in librarianship about, for instance, access to integrated databases, collection databases, quite strange. So for me, I suppose Matt's challenge to us that the default position for museums should be that the purpose of all collections should be about public access and that all of the collection should be front of house is a kind of no-brainer for a librarian, because that's fundamentally what our collections are about. They exist for use by whatever we call them, readers, researchers, clients, patrons, and the exhibition, the interpretation by library staff in traditional sort of public programs activities, although it's becoming increasingly important for libraries, and that's certainly where we learn from museum colleagues, is of course secondary to that function. Now, in some ways it's easy for us because, I mean, I look at those fantastic pictures of the Powerhouse store and think, thank God, I don't have those trains. Terry Irving, the guy who used to write the sale room column in the Financial Review, once wrote a scathingly critical column about the Mitchell Library when I was responsible for its collection, saying the Mitchell Library could lose a steam train in its tracks, so although we have small objects, we've got a hell of a lot of them. 10 million is what the National Library says, and that is not counting all the single individual pieces of paper or volumes in the 15,000 metres of our manuscript collection. So don't just think, oh, small is easy. We've always had the emphasis, obviously, on collection description, cataloguing, indexing and all the other collection management processes that actually enable users to then request and use collections in a way that is practically unmediated. And we don't really care what their purpose is. So they could be writing the definitive work on the life cycle of the common garden slug or a compendium of goldsmithing in Australia, and their purpose is, you know, equally interesting to us. But I think there are two trends in the kind of broader external environment that have perhaps meant that thinking about museums and the kind of traditional thinking in libraries has been brought closer together. And one of them is, you know, managerialism and the fact that externally there have been drivers which have forced us to think like an accountant about our collections, to put a value on them and to be able to account for them and to be able to control them. This asset that is in public ownership. And I actually don't think that's a bad thing, although I've cursed about having to value collections along with the rest of you. And the other one, of course, is the technological developments that have made it... it's now unsustainable to think you can just have your little specialist collection database that you've lovingly built up, knowing all that you do about whatever it is. Not only is there now an expectation from everybody in the world that they should have access to collection management databases, of course, we've gone much beyond that from when we were thinking about the millennium in 1996. I don't think we could have imagined Web 2.0 and how people wanted to tell us their stories about our collections, tell us what we didn't know about our collections and everything else. At one point, and I can't remember who was speaking, because I feel like I went to library school 2 centuries ago, but when I went to library school 30 years ago, we learned about some of the great theorists of librarianship, one of whom is Dr. Shiali Ranganathan. The two museum people I've asked had never heard of Ranganathan, so I'm going to take library licence and share with you Ranganathan's 5 laws of library science, because I think, and there's a point to this, I can't remember when these were written and I couldn't find it on Google, but the 5 are beautifully simple and beautifully eloquent and beautifully powerful. Books are for use. Every man his book, every book its man. Save the time of the reader. The library is a growing organism. Now, just forget the books and the man, although I actually love the antiquarian phraseology of that, and I don't like its... it has been, of course, crudely, I think, translated to every reader, its person. But I really do think those laws are actually widely applicable to museum collections, and clearly, you know, every man his book, there's the person who knows everything there is to know about slugs. and save the time of the reader. I mean, I think so much about collections management and now what is just taken for granted as how we must manage and control and be able to describe and make known our collections is partly about saving the time of the user, the visitor, whatever you want to call it. As I heard a number of people talking today, I thought actually the 5th law is the one that's really quite important. The library is a growing organism. And that's actually not so much about the growth, but about the organism, the ecosystem, the ecology. And I think what we've heard a lot today is about the museum, the library, the cultural institution, whatever we want to call ourselves, is this very complex ecosystem, which of course is made up of... components such as curators, registrars, conservators, and so on and so forth. And as with all ecosystems, sometimes in tension, but impossible, just implodes if you don't have the whole. So some of the things that I heard today that resonated for me... I too hate white gloves, Tyvek shrouds, the didacticism of the plasma screen, the authenticity of the higgledy-piggledy unmediated object is where I want to be. But I always feel in a when I am in a gathering of museum professionals that I'll go away fascinated by something I never thought I'd be fascinated about. And I was really glad to end up with that wonderful show and tell about the Royal Daimler. And the inherent vice of a Daimler will remain with me for a long time.
Thanks, Margie.
John, over to you.
Right, thank you. Yes, we all seem to be sort of posting how long we've been doing it. My first job in conservation started 34 years ago, so I beat Eric there. And actually, my very first experience of conservation in 1974, we actually smoked in the lab with acetone and meth. Yeah, it's surprising we were still. And that was in a very, very august institution, but never mind. We're trying to stop students from doing that. I was asked to do three observations, so I will do three observations because I'm a good boy and I do as I'm told. The first observation really is what seems to be coming out when people are talking about their experiences is that everything is changing. And I think that's good. That is a good, positive thing. Change is always a good thing, I think. In constant revolution, which may not be the best way of looking at it in museums, there's always new challenges. New challenges are coming up all the time. And although people perhaps initially resist some of these challenges, and some of us who've been in it 34 years mutter in our beards a bit, we are quite happy to look at these new challenges and to see if we can meet them and if we can reinvent ourselves. I remember 30 years ago, people were starting to look at plastics. We'd got over the plastics last forever sort of phase, and we were realising that plastics didn't last forever, and we were asking ourselves, what can we do with them? And 30 years ago, the answer was, I haven't the foggiest idea. Possibly nothing. We've risen to the challenge. We've looked at them. We've analysed them. People have written books about them. We've realised the importance of plastics collections, and this has the resonance in new technology. And now, 30 years later, we realise that we have almost no idea what to do about them. But at least now we know why we don't know what we do things. These changes are constant. They will come. 30 years ago, one of the big things in conservation was looking at the true nature of an object. Now, 30 years later, we're at last asking ourselves the question, what on earth do we mean by the true nature of an object? So we are really sort of starting to consider things. Secondly, I'd like to say that we are embracing this change. And from the talks that's coming, people seem to be happy to embrace the change. Changes make things exciting. So if we're willing to embrace this change, looking at, as you say, as Margaret was saying, it's a bit of a no-brainer, really. We're starting to look at the stakeholders. The stakeholders, the public, the museum staff, the museum professionals. I would even say the objects, perhaps, could be considered to be stakeholders because they also have their needs, although if a student wrote the object has their needs, I'd put a line through it. And we're now starting to look at what do people want. We're starting, instead of saying we know what you want, we're starting to actually ask, what do things want? How should we respond? The obvious idea of using sustainability. I mean, here in Australia, we've got a country that it may be 45 degrees outside and you're trying to keep it 20 degrees inside because of what happens to the objects. Now people are starting to say, what does happen to the objects? And realising perhaps it's not quite as exciting, it's not quite as a problem as we really thought. I mean, the question to that is, why on earth did it take us 30 years to go to that point? You know, it's a bit of a duh. You know, come on, we should have been thought of that ages ago. I just noted down here, gloves, white gloves. Has anybody ever done any research onto why you should wear gloves? If your hands are clean and dry, has anybody ever looked at it to find out, is there a problem? There you go, PhD for somebody. We work with forensics. So these questions are good, and we should be embracing these changes and... Yeah. Somebody said, and I can't remember who it was, that 30 years ago, conservation was regarded as a pseudoscience. Yeah, busted. You noticed. I would agree. It was a pseudoscience. We could get away with being scientists because we mainly work with artists, so we could impress them. hey, we got white coats. Now, 30 years later, there's some real science coming on. Some real questioning is quantifying it, questioning, analysis. And that, again, is coming through the way people are approaching things. Quite a few of the presenters have referred to Animal Farm. Remember in Animal Farm that when they opened the barn doors, every time they opened the barn doors, the rules had been rewritten. Now, that's the stage that we're at. And that, well, it wasn't much fun for the pigs, but it's exciting for us. We perhaps feel some of the pressure that the pigs are under, and we all have rules that we have to work under. And the idea of collection managers, good museum manager's bad or something like that. We all have to work together, so we may not like it, but we have to do it. And the last observation is the enthusiasm that's coming out. Museums are fun. I mean, some of us have been working in museums for over 30 years, but we're still finding them fun. I still find objects exciting. I love working with students. They ask difficult and awkward questions like, what are we going to do? And things like that. And that's good. The enthusiasm is coming over from people and from all different branches, all different areas, but the enthusiasm that it is fun, museums are fun, we are finding things out. If you're being stimulated, it means you're still thinking, and thinking is good. Obviously, I put an education slant on all of these things, and that's the way conservation and museum education is going, that we are perhaps throwing it back more into the students and making you think instead of saying, these are the ideas, we'll top you up a bit. With it. So those are my three observations. Apart from the last one, 3+1, just note, a lot of people here have been doing it for over 30 years, which means that at some point or other, they're going to have to stop us from doing it. We need a new generation coming on. We need students. We need people thinking. We need people moving up in the profession. Conservation was sort of invented. A lot of it sprung up in the UK about 35, 36 years ago through the Institute of Archaeology. That generation is, I was sort of on the next wave of that. That generation is going through. There's going to be some very, very prestigious posts in conservation vacant soon. So we should be looking out. We should be training. We should be looking at succession and saying, you know, who else is going to come here? Who's going to take over from us? So I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
Thank you, John. Michael, over to you.
I suppose I should just point out that what Louise had originally commented on in her introduction was that I do tend to sort of have a different view of just a museum perspective. Coming from the art gallery, they're quite different. I've spent about half of my career in one and now the other. So I've gone from sort of art history to social history, from fine arts to maritime. And they're big sort of gaps and the gulfs to try and sort of explore. It's always difficult coming after at the end of a session, and I suppose I've got some excuse being a sort of low status museum manager, which is rather pointedly, yes. And I suppose if Philip's still in the room, one of the strategies I'd probably suggest then is to get the curators to write museum executive position descriptions. That might sort of solve it all.
No, Philip's actually gone, I'm afraid.
Oh, right, okay.
You can say what you like.
Oh, good. So I've more or less just got a couple of observations I've made. I'd like to thank all the speakers. It was a really engaging session today, and it's been particularly helpful because I've just come from yesterday of running a division planning day for strategic planning, which finished at about 4:30, and I caught the plan to come here. So it's it actually gives me some sort of good ideas and arguments and other stimulating sort of things for me to consider when I go back. I'll just point out a couple of little observations I've made. And they touch on some of the things that have been said today. One of them is about what Margie was saying about managerialism. How do we... And I take it sort of a bit seriously about Philip's comment, not about me particularly, but I think it's an interesting one because I thought there was some logical flow to going from a curator to an assistant director. I didn't quite see it as sort of management. So I suppose really what I'm trying to say is, how do we sort of stop those divisions occurring? How do we sort of seem to have a better engagement between the different levels of people working in museums, that it's not us and them? Because clearly it came out today a little bit about that. And I think we need to sort of look at that quite seriously if that does exist. And I think it's really helpful if curators can be a little subversive, willful, inconvenient, because it does make places a little bit more sort of edgy and contemporary and things like that. One of the other things was about should we and how do we spend more time thinking of the philosophical underpinnings of of this notion of the off-site storage. It's probably Matt generated some of those sort of ideas. It seems to me that, not that he's got the hat of acting director at the moment in that context, but it does seem interesting that we're having a debate now about those things when we're on the path of doing it. Mm. So I think maybe we need to sort of look at exploring some of those ideas a bit earlier, about more the philosophy behind it rather than the nuts and bolts. I think there are lots of interesting innovations being explored in risk management of collections through lighting levels and exposure times, humidity and temperature variations, and they do provide new ways of seeing. But one of the great problems that I face in our museum is in international loans, and there seems to be no consistency about sort of when you're acquiring objects from other institutions. It ends up being, you know, one complete headache. And I think somehow it's all well and good for us here to be able to come up with these things, but somehow we've got to come together internationally and nationally about these. I thought that many of the projects referred here today, and probably understandably, related to national and state museums. And I think it's really important, given that I worked for over a decade in regional New South Wales, I think it is really important that we somehow translate some of these initiatives into those. So those places who don't have the facilities, the infrastructure, the expertise or the technical equipment, and many of them do have, you know, quite biggish collections and varied collections, we somehow need to sort of pass on and transfer that sort of information. And probably the last one for me was really another philosophical question, and it's probably based on my experience in art galleries and museums, is this in the end of the sort of presentations today about the interventions into the fabric of an object, which is about the, was it the Bentley or the?
Daimler.
And I can give a bit of a plug here about
Australian
Register of Historic Vessels has been dealing this for quite some time. But what it does is it raises some issues about would the museum, for argument's sake, have taken the painting of Queen Elizabeth if it was in such a dilapidated state and repainted and infilled the whole thing as you would with a car? Because, and it comes back to this notion of significance, because, and it's something that maybe Jennifer touched on the other day about research into the deaccessioning of collections and the dangers that you give them up too quickly without proper research. And it's a similar sort of thing with objects that can take on different significance. Like in industrial design, there has been a major shift to it becoming an aesthetic object. And there's no reason why some of these objects can't take on that sort of meaning, but they're put aside in some sense. So we have to be quite careful about when we're going to intervene, because certainly that is an issue within art galleries about the nature of infills and repainting, as most conservators know, and we'll probably fight with curators about. But I don't know how museums do it and whether they do it effectively, given that they traverse a lot of different material, both aesthetic sort of objects and social history type objects. So they were mainly, I suppose, my sort of observations of the day.
Terrific. Thank you, Michael. So over to you, and what we thought we might do is actually ask you to either respond to anything you heard from our speakers or to suggest yourself what has been the most interesting thing for you today that you will take away and perhaps talk about in your own institution. And I think we particularly want to hear from the younger set, to use an old-fashioned term. I think most of the speakers have been, as John observed, I think from the older generation, and we're not going to be here for much longer. So we're really interested, I'm interested to know what some of the people, what the younger people in the room think about what they've heard today and how we are going to go forward in the museum world addressing these issues. So let's see who's game. Oh, I don't know. Christopher.
It's a little bit of a reflection, but it's also a question. And I'm sort of new to the museum world. I was at the MCA for 12 years, so I'm also an art museum person before I came to the Powerhouse. One of the things that struck me when I joined the Powerhouse, and this is from people I know, they all said to me, why is it so dark? Now, today's comment about discussion about light levels I thought was interesting, but that was very much about the experience for the objects in the exhibition, and I wanted to know if anyone could reflect on the issue about the visitor experience, because there is a lot of feedback and about the Powerhouse, why is it always so dark? I also think this museum's incredibly dark, and I do think it does impact on visitor experience and ambience overall. So
I think it's true of all the big museums. That is a consistent complaint through our big museums. Who would like to respond? Anyone on the panel?
I can make an observation about it, and it sort of goes against what Philip's argument was, and that is that the curators and conservators do have a very powerful role in museums, and that other people, evaluation, marketing, often don't get a voice in the debate about lighting. It comes up in my museum all the time, but we haven't changed it since I've been there. That might be a reflection of my capacity, but I think it also largely reflects that sort of standards that are set by conservation and curatorial. That's my experience.
Nikki, up the back.
I can get on my hobby horse here. I'd like to respond by saying some of these light levels are set, for example, 50 lux to protect some of our most light-sensitive objects. But unfortunately, in my experience with some museums, is we then expect that light to also light the floor, light the graphic panels, light the text labels, light the emergency stairwell. So what conservation would really like is actually a more dynamic and more sophisticated lighting system throughout a museum. And we're often actually asking for light levels to come up, believe it or not, but a lighting designer or the designer for the exhibition will say, oh no, we want mood lighting, we want it to look dark and mysterious and we want the object to glow. You know, that's the kind of comment we get quite frequently. So some of you may not be aware, there's actually a standard for lighting in public places where the floor needs to be at least about 20, 25 lux, and I can probably pretty sure none of our exhibitions in the past have probably met that as a standard. But so I think there's a lot of room to improve lighting in museums, but it's unfortunate that sometimes I feel conservation gets blamed for poor exhibition lighting, when in reality we're actually trying to improve the situation and work to better visibility and better enjoyment for the public.
Thanks, Nikki.
John,
on the same topic, John?
Yes, on that topic, yeah, I would agree. I mean, as a conservator, I would agree. And I think museums also go for the element of theatre and the idea that it should be more theatrical if it's dark, which is a problem. A reflection, I was at the opening, just after the opening of the Museum of London, whenever that was, early 80s, in the Royal Textiles collection, and the lighting was so low, somebody who seemed elderly then to me fell down the stairs and was quite badly injured because the lighting was so low she just couldn't see where she was going. So, you know, I think it's theatre, a lot of it.
Okay, any further comments on this particular topic? Or, yes, is that one up the back?
Yes.
Okay.
I have been in a museum where there was actually a button where you could put extra light on the object if you actually wanted to read the text. And there are ways of dealing with it.
That's a solution, for sure. Mary?
I just wanted to say that at the Powerhouse some years ago, probably about 10 years ago, Pat Townley, who was the head of conservation there, worked with audience assessment to do a survey of audience there and their feeling about light levels to try and establish there'd been so many regular complaints about light levels. And so as a result of that investigation and survey work and thinking about the guidelines that had been set in conservation, the light levels were basically doubled. So for short-term displays. So it was with a view and consideration of the changeover, where lights were in the showcases, what the whole colour theme throughout a gallery was and reflected light. So I think there is, within conservation, a very, a generosity to trying to make works accessible on display, you know, and that's been there in the profession.
Thanks. Okay, Mr. Cooma Cottage with the beard.
Margie, you mentioned this dialogue between museums and libraries. So I'm just asking the question, is there a dialogue between state and this museum with regional museums? And if not, should there be? Or are we getting too close moving towards Paul Keating's original plan for this place, which was to have the money developing regional museums, and that's where the National Museum artefacts, treasures or whatever are housed?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you started with me. I mean, there's a strong relationship between, if you like, the three tiers of libraries. The National Library, where I am now, has no direct relationship with public libraries. That's with the state libraries in each jurisdiction. But there's a very strong relationship between state and public libraries within each state. I do think that as a librarian, my observation would be that there's perhaps been less feeling of having some sense of responsibility, obligation, some consultative and supportive relationship between large museums and smaller regional museums than is the case in libraries. I mean, all of this. I've worked in two state libraries. I've worked in the State Library of South Australia and the State Library of New South Wales. And, you know, my job as Mitchell librarian took me to places like Cobar, to the public library, or Broken Hill, where they had quite important collections of, you know, what in libraries is regarded as local studies. I would say as a librarian that I think from my observation, which is, you know, from outside and perhaps a little uninformed, I don't think museums have been as good at trying to do more, big museums, to support smaller regional institutions than perhaps the library sector has. Others may disagree.
Margie, I think you need to mention the Community Heritage Grants Program.
Yeah, but it's tiddly.
Well, true, yes, I suppose.
Can I add a question or an observation? I think it was what Marianne was sort of talking about earlier, which was about the nature of their needs in terms of regional and remote places, that they're not quite the same. They have a different sort of relationship with the publics. And I think that sort of typifies a lot of the problems with big state and federal institutions when they engage with smaller places, that they don't quite sort of understand what the relationship should be. Because there used to be lots of problems that, you know, when I was working in regional galleries, where we hated the National Gallery coming in and giving us culture.
Yeah.
You know, and it was a common sort of complaint. It was a bit silly. Mm-hmm. But there really is quite a different sort of thinking in regional places. And I don't think when you get more removed from it that you have a deep understanding of it. And I think that's where we've sort of got to explore.
Can I just add to that? I mean, I know virtually nothing about the Australian situation, but in the UK it was very similar, and over the last 5 or 6 years there's been a new project called Renaissance in the Regions, where the regional museums, who I suppose would equate to the large state museums, are acting as hubs, and they are hubs with different specialist interests, and those hubs have a responsibility for training and working with the smaller museums. And it seems to be quite an effective system. Now, there's no money in it, really, but, I mean, they are actually acknowledging that there are different levels of museums, different tiers, and that the knowledge can be passed down.
One up back, and then we'll go to Rebecca.
Hello. I've worked with volunteer museums for about 4 years. I don't do it anymore. One of the issues, not because I didn't want to, but they're not usually run by government. We're a totally different beast to what happens in England. It would be really lovely if we could have major institutions adopting a sister city relationship with a museum, where there's a reciprocal relationship. There's a bit of learning that happens both ways, and I hope Rebecca can talk a little bit about what Regional Services does. They've been fantastic, but part of the problem is that smaller institutions have the same problems you do, but far fewer resources.
Yeah.
And they just need a big brother.
Thanks. Well, Rebecca, in fact, has put her hand up, so...
Yes, I thought I'd just add a few words. I work at the Powerhouse and I manage the regional program there. I think there are problems with a big institution working with smaller institutions and exactly what is needed. But one of the issues, I think, which probably does need to be noted here, is that it's a matter of resourcing and priority. The big institutions often have people within them who do have the appropriate approach and the expertise and would love to get out there and work with their regional colleagues. But unless the funding is there to support those people and they're given the mandate within their work programs, it can't happen. So I think the big institutions do have to take that on board, whether it's arguing for the funds or finding the priority within their own resources. But it ultimately, it will come back to people putting that top of their list. Thanks.
Mm. Thanks, Rebecca. Matt Trinker. Oh, and Guy Hansen. All right, we'll go to Guy first.
Just responding to Michael's comments about the Daimler and you know, at what point would we say this is too far gone? And it's a very valid point. And to illustrate that point, I can say that there was another... We did know where the other surviving Daimler was, and it's in Rockhampton. And it is in much worse condition. And we had a good look at that car, and we realised that it was actually beyond that its significance had been completely obliterated by uses following on from that, and that the other Daimler, which we did purchase from South Australia, while it looks a mess, it is actually in quite reasonable condition, and we're very confident we can return it to you know, close to 54 with certain caveats, and that assessment took something of a year of internal discussions and very serious consideration, particularly because we knew we were looking at a project which might run for 3 years. The initial outlay, $90,000, but staff time was considerable, and there had to be a really serious consideration about whether the museum was prepared to embark on this process. So I think it's a very good point that Michael raised.
Thanks, Guy. Anyone else? Otherwise, we'll have to go to Matt Trinker. Matt, and then there's one over here, Lisa.
I was just going to pass a comment, I suppose, about what I thought was, you know, one of the more interesting things that got said today. And I mentioned this in my talk, but it was the young woman, I think, who mentioned the idea about allowing for sort of what I'll call planned ruin in collections. And I just want to say that the reason that, for me, that was one of the more interesting things to come out of that, and I include my own comments in that mix, is that, again, there's a challenge in there, or a provocation to us, to think about some of the underpinning, the undergirding of those assumptions we make about, you know, collections having value, them being preserved in perpetuity, all sort of assumptions that we find reasonably easy to make because they sort of underpin practice and what we think of ourselves professionally. But it's an interesting notion to think. People did say today that not all objects are equal, and that's partly along that sort of way, but that stream of thought, I suppose. But the idea that the museum might have a rather more varied sense of what object collections are than the ones that we commonly have, and it's through an engagement with audience. We haven't said a lot about audience. Michael said something just at the end, really, today, and it's been mentioned, but that you know, the audiences make the museum, and they might be making it through the collections being activated in some way as well. And you know, we cop that a number of the collections will be in a different state at the end of 50 years or 20 years or 10 years than they were at the start. So. Mm.
Mm. Any responses to that?
I was so happy that it flowed onto what spoke about, because that was exactly what I was trying to articulate.
Okay, great.
Can I just add that I think a very practical outcome of that is for Christopher to bring out the religious memorabilia from the Powerhouse Museum and talk to Hillsong. Yeah. You'll double your audiences overnight.
Lisa.
Hi. I guess mine's more of a comment, and people who know me will know I'm pretty passionate about volunteering and the power of volunteering, having worked with the volunteers here on the Enterprise. And I kind of feel that if we're serious about preserving cultural heritage and what we have left in Australia, which is not huge amounts of stuff, then we have a responsibility to help small organisations, historical societies and regional museums to preserve their collections. And that we, you know, it's not that we should do it for any other reason than we have a responsibility. Mm-hmm. I think that we should look at ourselves as big organisations and wonder what we're doing. And I also would like to put out there the, I guess, the example of the carriage, that would it make any difference if it was displayed in Cooma Cottage in the right conditions under the banner of the National Museum of Australia? Does it have to be on site? Mm-hmm. And how does that work for us? You know, we want more display areas. Does it have to be on site?
Yep. Yep, as Guy said, anything's possible. And that notion of the distributed national collection that was so alive in the 1990s, which is still kind of there, was a great framework then, really, for having that connection made between the national institutions and the smaller institutions. But it's kind of not something government wants to really promote right now. So now I had a question from Sarah over here.
Hi, I very much enjoyed today's papers. And this was actually mainly a question for Matt. Really interested in the idea of opening up collections, and I think in terms of the potential of engaging audiences, it's an exciting idea. But in terms of the actual practicalities of rolling it out, given, I suppose, all of the responsibilities that the National Museum has, both to the museum here and also to the regional communities that we've observed, I'd like to hear a bit more about the actual sort of potential practical rollout of this plan.
Oh, there's a plan. Give the man a microphone.
Didn't I say at the start of my talk that I wasn't speaking on behalf of the National Museum? There's great value in the 15-minute talk, Sarah, and the notion is that you only have to fill 15 minutes, so you don't have to have the plan. Look, I suppose what I was trying to do was act as a provocation to say, notwithstanding the fact that we're moving forward with various versions of enabling public access, that there's a considerable sort of realm of possible thought and then action, I suppose, as a result of that, that goes more neatly to this idea of should we really try and reconceive our the relationship, if you like, between public and collection. And that's not something that, I'll be honest, I have as a fully worked out plan. I suppose it's an invitation to people to join that debate about what that might mean for the museum through the course of its future. Because if you did move to consider not how you can enable access, what we're essentially saying in much of the open collections debate hitherto has been, how can I do what I'm doing and let the public see more? And I suppose what I'm saying is, no, is there something more fundamental we should ask ourselves, and that is, the public should have the opportunity of these collections and the interest in the collections that they want to have, which I suspect is rather greater than they do, and how does our practice substantially change? You know, how does it fundamentally change in museums to allow that to happen. What does a museum look like, I suppose, is my question. So it's a, again, it's the, you know, against myself, I suppose, it's the great line of being able to, you know, suggest a possibility and hope that someone else will answer the question. I do think that sometimes we imagine that that's harder, that some of these things might be harder than they seem. I mean, I use the example of the House Museum, I think, in a response to a question. And, you know, there are actually examples of museums that keep almost all or the greater part of their collection with a greater sense of public access to that collection, or at least public view, that allow a greater sense of affect. And by that I mean the capacity of the object to actually, you know, to be engaged with in its morphology, you know, its size, its shape, its volume, to understand something about that, what it is, as well as having some sense of interpretation or suggestion about meaning, which is part of the, you know, a kind of a curatorial job. So I'm not absolutely convinced it's as, you know, sort of impractical as it might first seem. I just think we haven't thought about it a lot. Mm. I mean, I think it certainly means that we would not be collecting as much. It's hard for me really to believe that each, and I go back to this question again, each of the 200,000 objects in our collection, and it's only 200,000. You have to remember that there's museums in this country with millions upon millions of objects in their collection. So 200,000 sounds like a lot. It's a relatively small collection. Well, I'm sure that there's a lot of material in that collection which is of modest value for various reasons. And I'm not discounting it, but, you know, I think you saw in some of the suggestions that are coming now from conservators that they realise that too, and thinking about a gradation of treatment, a gradation of the way we think about objects. To me, that suggests that, you know, some of those objects don't need to be in storage that is isolated, quiet, dark all the time. And that you know, if they're in a public facility that we conceive of as a collections place that is the museum, that allows people to see and experience a range of objects, that means that obviously high-value, fragile materials are still kept with a sense for their future. But we do that in exhibitions now. If we looked at the really high-value objects, say, in our collection, most of those things are on display. I'm talking about the greater part of the collection that's not on display and whether it should be, you know, on a greater sense of public view. We've figured out, in truth, how to keep the Batman land deed, for instance, here in this museum, on display almost all the time. There's other ways of dealing with some of these issues apart from saying we have to put them in a store. I do think that the demarcation between store and public space is one that the open collections model has moved to try and address, and I think there's some excellent examples of that, and we heard that today. But that's not really asking a more fundamental question about whether that practice suits public need. Is that a fair sort of sense of answer to the question?
That's good, because we're about to run out of time, and I'm acutely aware I took the microphone away from this young woman, and she is young too.
My childishness will be proved by what I'm about to say, but because it's 4:30 on a Friday afternoon, you have to forgive me. I was also really taken by that very intelligent comment about, or what I thought was a very intelligent comment, about the deaccessioning, letting something deaccession itself. I thought that was a very interesting idea. I've got a few ideas sort of floating around, but I've been thinking in terms of natural history collections and how allowing a specimen to deaccession itself can actually be used as an interpretive device. I recently did a project on the King Island emu, which is a dwarf extinct species of emu from King Island. Believe it or not, and it was some specimens were collected in 1802 by the Bourdain expedition. And there are very few specimens of this animal left on the planet. One of them is in Paris, at the Natural History Museum in Paris. Actually, there are two there. They used to be on display, but now they are too precious to be put on public display. They are, you know, there are so few specimens of this animal that they are too precious to be put on public display. But the museum has 75 million specimens. 45 million of those specimens are insects, but still, that's an awful lot of critters. And I thought, what a shame that we can't put this animal on public display, not only because it's precious, but also it's too old and ugly and decrepit to compete with the admittedly magnificent taxidermy that is on display. That if you ever get the chance to go to that museum, it is mind-boggling. The animals look like they're about to turn around and bite you. They're so realistically rendered. I thought it would be a really good idea to put this animal on display because its decay and its decrepitude and the fact it's falling apart will say more about the nature of extinction than putting it down in a vault three stories underground in Paris. But of course, we have to let go, and yet we can't let go because as you know, museums are, what is it, the museums are the DNA of our civilization, archives are the DNA of our civilization. These animals are the DNA of life on Earth and death on Earth as well. So I guess, I don't know what my point is, but the thought that I think that's a really interesting idea. Yep. And that maybe, you know, maybe things aren't meant to be forever. You have to let go sometimes and let it, the ephemeral reveal itself, if that's...
I thought it was the ultimate in slow drift.
Yes. But this is the real meaning of extinction, is that this animal has been driven to extinction and it's falling apart. So let's show it. Let's not hide that fact. But I guess in terms of a social history museum, the things we need to think about are slightly different. Yeah.
Can I just add a rather sort of boring technical point? Australia now has a specialist natural history conservator who has about 10 years' experience in the Natural History Museum, who is now working for Museums Victoria. Mm. Felicity Bolton, she was one of my students many years ago. There you go.
We've got one more here from Marianne, and then I think we're going to have to stop. Sorry, everybody.
Thanks for letting me speak, Louise, especially because I'm not young. Young... people from the UK will know a lot more about this than me, but I think there's been a lot of thinking and talk and action in the UK about opening up access to collections in storage. And Suzanne Keane has driven a lot of the thinking around this and worked with a lot of the major institutions and come up with a whole lot of ideas about the way in which you can open up collections out of storage and within storage. And, you know, eminent institutions like the British Museum, I think, are starting to do some really innovative things, with the exception of repatriation. But they are travelling really significant objects around, presumably at the knowing sort of cost of their preservation. So I actually think that the UK is worth looking at, and I've got a sense that their thinking is ahead of us in this regard.
Okay, thanks. We will have to draw proceedings to a close, so let's do this. Let's have me remind you that you should fill in your evaluation forms. Have you all done that? If you haven't, you need to do it before you go. Let's say thank you to all of our speakers and the organisers. Let's do that now. And Peter's running down the stairs. I'm sure he's got something to say.
So, Guy.
Okay, he's going to talk to Guy. At the risk of being immodest, Philip Jones, who had to leave to start a trek to travel to London, asked me to say publicly that he had found the day very inspiring. And, I mean, partly because of his great talk, I think, at the beginning of the day was inspiring for us, and that he was deeply impressed with the quality of papers that had been presented today, and he particularly wanted to remark, this is the immodest bit, that he thinks that the extent of expertise at the National Museum around collections and the commitment to collections has grown dramatically in the last few years, and he wanted to make that comment public. So I'm just going to see what the lads are doing over there. Peter, Guy, is there anything you would like to finish off with? Peter? Is there anything you would like me to do? Or is there anything you would like to do?
Okay.
Thank you. Now, I think I mentioned drinks at University House earlier. University House is the closest place you can have a drink. And if you just walk up to the hill, up the hill to ANU, it won't be very hard to find. Unfortunately, myself nor neither Guy nor myself can join you because of family or work commitments. But is there anyone from the museum who would be thinking they might go and have a drink so we can at least... Matt. So everyone should follow Matt. Don't put your hand up if you're not listening. Can I say finally, thank you to all of you for coming. It was fantastic to see so many of you and such a terrific amount of interactivity and discussion about what is still a really critical issue. And we've talked a lot about the last 30 years and where we are now, but I've been reflecting on where we're going to be in 30 years, in 2040. It will be very different from where we are now. That's about the only thing I think we can say. So thank you, everyone.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.